The invisible hand contains sensitive material that could threaten the safety of our contributors. To protect the identities of those involved, we will mostly be using first names or pseudonyms. Content warning. This series contains graphic audio relating to animal cruelty and some violent themes which may be distressing to some listeners. These episodes were written to be listened to chronologically. This is Chapter 6. Reality cannot be deprived of the other echoes that inhabit the garden.
Our cultures comprise an ever-expanding Venn diagram of stories. Chinua Achebe said, "People create stories, create people." Or rather, stories create people, create stories. He conceived of the art of stories, therefore, as an effort to create for himself a different order of reality from that which is given to him. He also said, "The world is like a mask dancing. If you want to see it well, you cannot stand in one place." Because some stories are told in loud, booming voices, they drown out others. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie says the word inkale is a noun which loosely translates to be greater than another. Stories, she says, like the structures they build, are defined by the principle of inkale. My name is Georgina Savage, and this is The Invisible Hand. Chapter 6. Reality cannot be deprived of the other echoes that inhabit the garden.
Okay.
Sophia, come on. Come. Not today.
Okay,
in the car. Bye, Ben. I'll see you in a few weeks, okay?
1 month. I don't want you to leave.
Oh, Bobby. It's okay, I'll be back.
Okay. Whatever.
Love you. I'll come back with adventures and stories.
Okay.
Bye, Sophia.
Cheers.
Bye. Thank you so much, Greg. Good luck, man. Appreciate it. I'll send you messages every day.
Great. Do that.
Cool.
I've left South Africa having spent over a month deep in the bush of the Kruger National Park, living and working alongside Tam and Greg, and feeling a part of their little family unit. The access Greg gave me to voices within the conservation ranks was extensive, but admittedly limited. I'm now driving across the border to Mozambique, which borders Greg's section of the park. Though Sabi Village, where I'm heading, and Lower Sabi Camp, where I'm coming from, are geographically close as the crow flies, I need to drive down to the border crossing and all the way back up again. It takes me about 4 hours to get there. I'm meeting my fixer and translator, Domingos Bungani, in the nearby town of Moamba. I feel slightly embarrassed because there was a mix-up with the car hire. I'd asked for a low-key 4x4, something that's seen the roads I'll be driving on. Something inconspicuous. Turns out they didn't get the memo, and the only car available was a brand new, sparkling white Nissan X-Trail, which makes my already indiscreet presence all the more glaring. So I'm just now driving into Moamba to find Domingos on the street. So hopefully I do, because I don't have any reception. Okay, I can see him.
Georgina, give me a kiss.
Oh my god, oh my god, I nearly choked you. Hi, how are you?
Well, here in Mozambique, we give kisses like.
Okay. Should I need to learn these things?
That's what you have to do when we're there. Well, let me get in so we'll talk.
This is Domingos Bungani. He's 24 years old and one of few university educated people in his village. Some people in his community call him schoolboy, which he both loves and hates. He's studying hotel management in the city of Inyambani, about 500 kilometres northwest of Moamba. We'd chatted on the phone a few times before meeting. I found his details during my research because of a university project he submitted in which he addressed the issue of both rhino extinction and the death of young community members in Sabi due to the poaching crisis. In his proposal, he wrote, "Mozambicans drown in their own blood because of the armed response of the rangers, concerned about the problems of this barbarian, in quotation marks, against this endangered species." On the phone, Domingos told me he wants young guys in his community to stop poaching because the lure of this money is destroying their lives. He's excitable, chatty, extremely charismatic. Plus, he speaks English, Portuguese, and Shangana, the local tribal language of this area. When I pick him up, he's looking schmick, far more put together than I am. He's wearing a crisp white button-up shirt, jeans, and nice shoes. We pick up a few things, a SIM card for me, some credit for him, and we head off to his hometown, Sabi Village. He tells me he'd like to be driving when we arrive.
You know, it's always good to be part of something, especially like this big project that you brought, this big work I have to translate, for example. It's like, I don't know. I'm not really sure I'm ready for this, but I want to take the challenge because I want to be part of it. That's it.
And also, like, who is better equipped to tell the story of Sabi than you?
Yes. That's why I feel a little bit... I feel this pressure somehow. Yes, I want it to be perfect. That's why. I mean, I will be myself. I'm always myself. But I have to give an extra effort here.
And you just have to make sure that you drive safely.
Absolutely. That's what I'm focusing. Can't you see? That's what I'm focusing on the street.
And it really feels like we're going into the depths of the rural part of the country, and Sabi feels like it's going even deeper and deeper and deeper into the wilderness of Mozambique.
Absolutely. Wait to see. Just wait to see.
Sabi Village is located in the district of Moamba, in the southernmost province of Mozambique, Maputo. The village sits about 100 kilometres from the capital city. The people of Sabi are Mashangana, part of the Shangan tribe. The Shangan are part of the Tsonga tribes that lived in Mozambique in the mid-1800s. King Shaka of the Zulus of South Africa sent Shashanga to conquer the Tsonga people in what is now southern Mozambique. He gave his name to the people. Due to Portuguese colonial invasion, violence, civil war, flooding and droughts, Mozambique remains an impoverished country, but is considered a fast-growing economy. Domingos drives me through the winding back streets of his village. There's goats and dogs running, kids laughing and waving at us. He waves back, proud. People appear shocked to see him in this car. He wants to stop at various houses to say hello. I smile as he translates basic introductions for me. There's kisses on both cheeks, hands held. Some seem more dubious of my arrival. They appear to be standing back and watching with scepticism. Domingos assures them that I'm not a spy. I'm here with him to work on this documentary. The dirt roads that wind their way around the village are narrow. There's wire fences covered in branches that act as hedges and property dividers. Some properties have multiple houses on them, small brick structures with corrugated iron roofs. Chickens run playfully after one another. I can smell onions and cassava leaves cooking in the distance.
How are we going to communicate? We want to say things, but how are we going to communicate?
It's okay, we'll figure it out.
Soy português.
Yeah. You'll just have to teach me Portuguese tomorrow. Tonight.
Só tenho que me ensinar português hoje à noite.
Tonight. You'll just have to work really hard.
Yeah, really hard. Today, tonight, I have really big work.
We pull up to Domingo's house where his family is waiting for us. I meet his mum, Carolina, and his dad, João, his sisters, Casilda and Helena, and his little brothers, Edu and Cirilo. His sister, Casilda, is heavily pregnant, probably 8 months, and her son, Edilson, also lives here.
Okay.
Yeah.
How was the trip for you?
It was great. It was a little scary with him driving.
Assustador com ele dirigindo.
He was a bit fast.
Ele era rápido.
I was stressed, but then I relaxed.
Mas depois relaxou. Foi muito bonito.
Yeah. And the sun setting, and it was like all of the bush and the desert.
Immediately, Carolina and Casilda wrap me in a capulana, which is the traditional fabric of Mozambique worn by every woman as a skirt.
Hi.
Okay. Hello, Georgina.
Where are we?
Now we just arrived at home, and this is the gate of the house you see. And
you're going to show me, you're going to give me a bit of a tour of your house and exactly. How things work.
Exactly, everything, so that you do not get confused about some things, because different cultures, different lifestyle, right?
Yeah.
Well.
So what can we see in front of us? We're walking into the gate.
Just because this is the season of rains, raining season, we have a lot of green, as you see. Some of these greens, it's not like all grass, it's food, okay? You can see here corn crops. As you can see, this is our food. Pumpkin leaf, we eat it with maize meal. It's really good. You can prepare it with oil or, if you prefer, with coconut and peanut. So that's a different two ways of preparing it. It's really nice.
Yum.
This is where we get our food.
This has to kind of sustain the family for the whole year.
Yeah, for the whole year, exactly. That's how it works. He was asking if we saw the goats.
He was like, uh-oh, where are my goats?
Yes, exactly. So.
And what's going on here on our left?
On our left, we have my younger brothers, twins, Cirilo and Edu. They are 8 years old. Quantos anos vocês têm, Cirilo? 8 years old. And they are taking care of the goats. Those goats are their responsibilities. In the morning, they have to take them to eat. Then this time, they have to take them back home.
What age did they become the kind of goat carers?
When they're six years old, you can find 6 years old children taking care of goats.
And you used to take care of goats when you were their age as well?
Yes, I did. I had six of them. And this is kakana, or this plant is kakana. Also our food. I like it so much, but it's bitter. Some people do not really like it because it's bitter, but it's really good for healthy. It helps you to avoid malaria.
Oh, amazing. Uh-huh, exactly. I need to get me some of that.
Yeah, you should get some of that. Of that.
And really so nice. How often do people get malaria here?
Do you know what? I only had malaria like January 15th, no, 16th January this year.
Oh my gosh, like 3 weeks ago.
3 weeks ago, I just had malaria. So this is a big marula tree. Sharing stories, we have this Nkaringana Wankaringana, which is like the cultural and real historic, which is dying, unfortunately. But I had the privilege of living in that generation, that we used to sit under the trees with the bonfire. A grandpa would start telling us a story. I've heard a lot of rabbit stories and monkey stories and a lot of things about everything. But also about the war, what started the war, with the civil war, with the colonization and stuff.
And when did people stop doing that?
Look, because of the globalization, just a few houses or families had electricity. Mine didn't have electricity. We had electricity only 2006, when we had electricity at my house. We would just sit because we don't have to sleep. What do? Bonfire. So as we got much more electricity, like
phones and
phones and things, we didn't need stores and bonfires anymore. Yeah, that died. So electricity and phones, ironic, right? Cell phones and electricity killed some habits in Serbia and cultural habits.
This conversation with Domingos speaks to the conundrum of development, that some cultural practices worth preserving inevitably get lost in the process. And yet those of us who benefit from the privileges of living in wealthy nations can understand the desire from communities like that of Domingos to move towards benefiting from the same luxuries, even if that process comes at the expense of things that seem precious. The process of evolution within these communities is sort of like taking a round of antibiotics for an acute infection. The body in the analogy is the community. The infection is the old system of oppression, prone to killing vital organs and spreading bad bacteria, like bad ideas. The bacteria needs killing off, reforming. And the antibiotics are the impulse to reform the culture in which we live, sometimes thought of as the drive for progress. The issue with antibiotics is that as well as eliminating the bad bacteria at the infection site, the antibiotics may also eliminate some of the good bacteria, which in the analogy is the beneficial cultural practices that may have been better off preserved. Sophie spoke to Professor Nwando Achebe again about storytelling as cultural practice, which might give you an idea of its value and what's at stake.
African history is performed. It's performative. African history is sung. African history is danced. African history is recited. It relates to oral history in the sense that how do we conceptualize our history? When I talk about archives, I talked about the colonial archives. But in my mind, the true African archives reside in individuals. These older men and women in the community that have the history, that live the history of, you know, African people and are able to pass along this history from one generation to the next. In families, you have individuals, mothers, fathers, aunts, uncles, that pass on family history, cultural history from one generation to the next, right? They do that within the family structure. You know, a lot of these older people in the rural areas are not going to particularly be able to speak to you about any dating of African history. And the reason is that that's not the way that Africans conceptualize their history. African history flows from one event to the next to the next.
Everything started happening really fast.
Modernizing really fast.
Exactly, modernizing really fast. And we would not even use it anymore. Especially because we have lack of rain lately. So we did not produce a lot at the farms, at the local farms. Because we depend on rain. We did not use the artificial irrigation method. Yeah. So because of that, people saw the need of working for money so that they could buy maize meal, and they could buy rice, for example. They could buy food, because before that, like, I'm serious right here. Most of the families 10 years ago, we didn't have to buy shit. It's not
okay,
raining.
Okay, so
enough.
Because it's not raining enough, then yeah. There's not enough crops to feed everyone, and so people really depend on other forms of income to survive.
Exactly, lack of money started to be relevant. Like, we started to see, like, we need money. If you have enough money to buy the basics, clothing and this stuff, you are good, because food you do not buy. You have it from the farms, you have it from mashambas.
When would you say that you noticed that people weren't able to feed themselves off their own farms?
10 years ago. A lot of people couldn't go to the farms because it's not raining. We have nothing to do at the farms. Most of people didn't have money because they had no jobs or some had jobs, some didn't have jobs. Those that have jobs, their salary is like misery, you know. Some used to go to South Africa to try to find like better conditions of life. Everyone tries to survive. And then like to see that one person's coming up with a lot of money at once, want to see where is that money coming from. And then people started to go pushing because of that, because they needed money, they needed food.
Why do you think, in your opinion, people didn't just go and poach once, get their money, and then live off that for a while? Why did people start spending it very quickly on things that would make the money go like in a second?
At the beginning, it was easier to go there and poaching. It was easier. So people...
There were so many more rhinos.
Yes. So they would go, but then money finishes, I'm going again. There are people who would even go like twice in a month. Easy money. So people would do that a lot. Like, it's a lot of money at the same time. 5,000 medigash for these people, like before, especially. Wow. You were a rich man.
For context, 5,000 Mozambican metikash is around 50 British pounds, or 100 Australian dollars.
You were a very, very rich man if you had that money. You would do a lot of things. 10 years ago, with 2,000 metikash, you would buy land like this.
And do you see poaching as a big part of the reason as to why the village has grown?
It's undeniable that poaching brought money to the village. If someone has 2,000 metikash and he's from Sabia, he will spend it right here. Or he will buy a car, but then gas will buy around here. He will need food. He will buy where? Here. I have my shop. He will buy food in my shop. I'm growing. He has 5,000 metikash. He's building a house. He's buying cement in my shop. And he's hiring a constructor from Sabia. He's building a house. So now we have conventional houses in the Sabia. And cars are around. You see, cars are everywhere. And, that's a car.
So there were never cars around before?
There were cars, but not as many as now. Trust me. If you had a car, you were rich. You were one of the rich people in Sabia. Like, if you had a Toyota, you are a damn rich man.
Domingos and I quickly get into the habit of cruising through Sabi in the rental car. He likes to be in the driver's seat.
Okay, so Domingos, why don't you tell me what we're doing right now?
Hello, Georgina. So now we are hanging out. We are in a tour in Sabi. I want to show you what rhino poaching has done to us, like in terms of, I mean, noticeable things, or maybe good, so to say. For example, some people use their money to build their own houses and, to buy their cars, to start some small businesses and not go back there.
Do you think they don't go back there?
I'm not sure they don't go back. So most of them go. But anyway, still they did something for the economy of the community.
And so how do you know who got their money from poaching and who didn't?
It's just like everyone knows everyone here. Everyone knows everyone here. And if you are just a Domingos, not working anywhere, we know that you're every day just hanging around, walking to the market, walking to whatever. And then just within a week, you come back with a lot of money. And you show off your money. For example, this business here, it's from rhino poaching.
The owner. What is this business?
This is where they fix cars. How do you call it?
Oh, like a car mechanic.
Car mechanic, yeah. And the car over there, that's Alteza. He bought it, and the same time he started this business.
Wait, maybe don't say the name.
Alteza.
Yeah, don't say. Is that his name?
No, it's the name of the car.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We have no evidence to support Domingo's claims that this specific mechanic is funded by rhino money, but there's no doubt the community is advancing quickly.
And after the market, there is this small shop that was being started. He used to be my brother-in-law. He was my brother-in-law. He went poaching. He got his money. He bought his car. He went again. He started to build this business, very beautiful project of his here. That's back when poaching was still like high stage. How do you say that?
Like at its peak.
Yeah, at its peak. He built the infrastructure, right? But couldn't finish with the money. Then he went back again. As he came back, he bought a BMW, big motorcycle. Really big and really nice motorcycle. I remember he was still celebrating.
And what did you think at the time? Did you think that was cool? That he was pretty cool for what he was doing?
Yes, it was cool because he could do whatever he wanted. It was like investing. He was having fun at the clubs. He was having this fancy car. I remember it was like a CRV, really nice one, and he bought himself like this BMW big motorcycle. The same day he just arrived from Maputo with a lot of money, with a new motorcycle BMW. He had an accident right here in the market because he drove it and it came like high speed in a car. This is the project, what you see here on your right.
Okay, so it's like a abandoned building that was half built. It's now kind of overgrown. How did his death affect you and the community?
We lost a young man from Sabi. The community lost a young, very smart, intelligent man, young man. My friend's sister lost a husband. They had this, maybe she was five or four years old, a little girl, a daughter. So she's orphan of a father. They had like this newborn baby, and which never got to know his father. Just little boy right now. I think now he's like maybe six or seven now, which means it's 7 years ago tragedy.
How does it feel now looking at this empty construction site that was going to be his dream? How does it feel sitting in front of it and seeing that it kind of will never happen?
It's so sad. So sad.
Do you blame poaching for his death?
Well, no. He didn't die there. He died happy with his money. And now we are in front of this gas station being built in Sabi. It's really cool because we would have a gas station in Sabi. He's not an organization, it's just a guy who wants to build a gas station.
Are you insinuating that this is a poaching person, someone who's poached who has decided to invest in a gas station?
Yep, exactly.
And so for you, is this a kind of example of the way in which poaching has helped the community to a certain degree? Because people don't have petrol station nearby, they have to drive over an hour to get petrol, to get fuel, whereas a poacher has tried to bring petrol to Sabi, which would make people more free.
Exactly. And like more than that, helping... I'm not supporting poachers, okay? I'm just saying that, well, the money is somehow helping the community. The economy of this community has reached higher rates. Is that okay? Yeah, rates. But not good. I wouldn't support rhino poaching.
Is it quite a conflict for you within, then?
It's money. Money is needed. The community needs money. We're talking about people who used to take care of cattle and not to be paid with money, only with a cow per year. Do you feel me? We're talking about people who never had a salary of 5,000 meticais per month. You feel me? We're talking about people who never had an opportunity to go to school, to have access to school. We're talking about people who don't even know how to write their own names, you see. And then all at once, the opportunity came up. You now have 800,000 meticais in your pocket. What's that? That drives people crazy. You know, that drives people crazy. It is increasing our economy in the community, as a community, you see. But still, it's a crime. It is a crime, but it is increasing the economy of Sabi.
Yeah, like maybe to be realistic about the situation, it doesn't need to be a binary of all good or all bad.
Yes, you feel me. It can be good and bad at the same time. That's the situation here, because people are giving themselves the opportunity of getting money to live the life like they wished before. You know, this economy was built under this old system of poaching, right? But, I mean, this is complicated, Georgina.
So complicated. Again, Domingos believes this gas station was funded by rhino poaching money, but we have not been able to verify this.
Whoa. Oh my gosh. That was scary.
Yeah,
the car driving so fast.
Poacher.
Look, a lot of cars you see here are poachers' cars, but now mostly the broken ones, mostly the broken cars, and just built this new, someone was starting building it and stopped and is living in the poacher alert.
I guess what you're saying is pre-poaching, this village looked very different. Nearby, I can see there's a guy washing his truck. There's a club that looks quite fancy. Its walls are painted bright orange and bright blue. It reminds me of something you'd see in Joburg, actually. To my right, there's a cake shop. It's also modern. And on the road leading into town, there's huge concrete houses. Some even have two stories. There's large fences and sometimes multiple cars parked out the front. There's a stark difference between these and the shack-style houses out in the distance. The older structures are significantly smaller and traditional in style, with thatched walls and corrugated iron roofs. Here is a town undergoing rapid change.
It seems without poaching, there's no way to do that here.
There is no way to do that without poaching.
Be important also to say not all poachers are Robin Hoods.
This is Annette Hubschler, who you've heard from previously. She's a sociologist and criminologist at the University of Cape Town. Her work focuses on illegal wildlife trade issues, general policing issues, climate change resilience, and general organised crime issues in sub-Saharan Africa.
Initially, when I started interviewing Kruger rangers and other people working in the conservation industry, everybody was talking to me about these Robin Hoods and, you know, false economies and poaching villages. And when I went in, I realized there was, for example, there was this young teenager. I mean, he was literally a teenager who'd just come back from Kruger National Park. And he was living fast. Obviously, some of the money was spent on local produce, but it was sort of fast-moving consumer products, good clothing, cars, these sort of things. Some other poachers and also, you know, sort of the mid-level organizers, hunt organizers, or I used to call them rhino kingpins, so the ones that organize the hunts and pass on the horn. A lot of them were providing services to the community that the state doesn't. And that's especially true in Mozambique, where you don't have water. So some of the kingpins and even some of the poachers were sinking boreholes. They were building little roads. They were assisting some community members with money for school. Just, you know, it reminded me a bit about research that I'd been doing on gangs and gangsterism, where often gang leaders will support a whole community and then the community supports you. And it wasn't that obvious in the rhino poaching case, but you could see there was a trickle down. And unfortunately, the areas of rural hinterlands are amongst the poorest areas in southern Africa. So there are very few services. If you go around, even in South Africa, a lot of the villages around Kruger National Park, they don't have a shopping centre, they don't have a hospital, they don't have a police station. So just the most basic services are not available.
A Casa Furtiva trouxe muitas mudanças. Por quê? Porque a partir da Casa Furtiva, a maior parte dos jovens daqui de Sá, da nossa comunidade, não preocuparam mais em seguir os estudos todos.
This is Domingo's little sister, Helena. She's tall and stoic, but also playful. She's constantly busy working here, cooking meals for the family, scrubbing the huge pile of dishes each morning, sweeping the floors and washing laundry. On top of that, she's studying to become a pharmacist. She and a colleague run a little hairdressing business out of her friend's house on the side. Helena is only 21 years old, but she is busy. Poaching came to Sabi when she was still in high school, and some of her friends were involved as teenagers.
Young people would quit school to go poaching because they would say, like, even without finishing school, I could have a lot of money at once that everyone wants.
How young would some of these people be that would be going?
A
lot of people living 17, just 17 years old. If someone came and gave him a weapon to go poaching, would just quit school and go. Even some of my colleagues, she said, would left school and never came back.
Wow, how does that make you feel, and how did that affect you and your friendship groups?
I feel tudo de uma forma negativa porque para a pessoa que foi para lá para a caça furtiva.
She said yes, it affected us negatively because they would just leave school and never come back. So that's like one less educated person for the community and for the family, for his family. So it really messed up with everyone because a lot of people who go there, they come and they're not really visionaries and they do not have big ideas, they do not have big projects, they do not think of investing. They'll just come back with a lot of money and do nothing. So that was one more less young educated man for the community.
What did the young people, your friends that would go and do this, what would they spend their money on?
They would just spend the money with beers, buying cars with girls. They would just ride the car for the period, the short period of time, and then everything goes back to normal.
And what did people at school think about it? Did they think that these guys were really cool because they had money, or were people really against it? What was the kind of vibe of the young people in your community?
I would just look at them and feel sorry for them because we all knew that it was just easy money and easy good. It came from a crime, and pushing is illegal in Mozambique. And these young pushers would just come and suddenly their behavior would change because of a lot of money. They would just behave strangely. They would be like just annoying and not very cool. They would just lose their minds. Even though it was a lot of money at the same time, wouldn't want it because he knew it wouldn't even help himself. So we don't really appreciate it.
And were there any women or young girls like around your age that were really into it because suddenly these guys had money and they wanted to be near money?
Sim. Muitas meninas se aproveitavam.
She said yes, a lot of girls would do that. A lot of girls would just hang out with them because of money, and that destroyed them. So they let themselves take advantage of themselves because of it. And a lot of them ended up pregnant and lost school because they would not go back to school as they're pregnant. A lot of them even got illnesses like
STIs?
STIs because of it. AIDS. Because of it, and because when one come with a lot of money, would hang out with a lot of girls.
Well, my name is Alcinda Hornuana. I'm an anthropologist and centennial professor at the London School of Economics and Political Science. I'm also the strategic director of the Firoz Lalji Center for Africa at LSE. Yeah, and I am originally from Mozambique as well.
That's Professor Alcinda Hondwana talking to Sophie.
In a way, I understand these young men come from communities that are completely ravaged themselves in the sense that there are no resources. So if you make money with a criminal activity or from poaching or whatever in a very kind of a fractured and debilitating environment, some of them might boast and want to show that they have a lot of money and have girls and party rather than using the money wisely. But there isn't a structure, there isn't a context that allows you to properly plan your life or a decent life. You don't wake up one day and you are an entrepreneur and you know how to manage money. You don't have those skills. Young people, they understand exactly their predicament and they understand the situation they are in, because this is a generation that is growing up in the age of globalization and internet and all these new technologies of communication and information sharing. And so they know exactly what's happening in the world. They know and they can compare their own situation to the lives of other young people elsewhere, in China, in the US, in Australia, in Europe, wherever. And they know that they're getting the short end of the stick. And they know that they could live better. They are part of this consumer culture, that they're watching that consumer culture. But they want the jeans. The girls want the long hair and the hair extensions. They want the iPods and the iPads and the computers. Why not? They want the smartphones, but they cannot have it.
Of course.
And that creates a contradiction, a very strong contradiction. But also creates a kind of a youth consciousness about these new aspirations of the global world, which the generation of their parents didn't have. And so these young people have this consciousness, and from time to time they rebel against it. They say enough is enough.
Whilst poaching groups usually have a tracker or hunter on their team who's older and more experienced, there's also a young recruit learning the ropes. After about six hunts, they're considered experienced enough to lead their own group. This means many young men from Sabi are signing up to be involved in poaching. I wanted to hear from a young man in the community who would fit the description of a poaching recruit.
Primeiro, eu nasci aqui em Sabi, com a minha mãe, aqui na vila de Sabi. Cresci aqui, estudei aqui, faço a minha vida aqui em Sabi.
He was saying that he was born here in Sabi. His mother is, well, right here. He grew up here, and all what he know, he learned from Sabi. That's what he said.
This young man, like most of the people I'll speak to in Sabi, wants to remain anonymous. I'm going to call him AJ, obviously not his real name. AJ is around 25. He's known Domingo's family his whole life. His mother is friends with Domingo's mother, Carolina. He works here as a minibus driver, taking workers from the village out to the fields to work. Here at his place there's a few cars, which seems strange to me, but they're all broken down. All the tyres are flat, and one has a smashed window. Domingo tells me that he's willing to talk to me about poaching.
Na parte de tecnologia, falando do internet em si.
Não era qualquer acesso.
Well, from 2000 until now, it became a little bit easier for people to have cell phones, although they were really expensive. So only those who had like money, enough money to buy them, could buy. Like, we didn't have smartphone by then. So internet, especially, no one could have like internet here in Sabi until 2000. And 10, he said, until now, started having internet, so anyone could have Android phones or cell phone that could have access to internet.
And so what happened in 2010 that allowed people to have access to phones finally and to be able to afford them?
Acompanhando nas televisões. A entrada do outros países em Moçambique.
Because people could see cell phones in other countries, like seeing what's happening in other countries, they started like wanting those phones, and the interest of foreigners bringing these new cell phones to Mozambique, so people wanted to have those as well.
And so would you say around that time there were a lot of opportunities for young men like you to have employment?
Não, para jovem não havia oportunidade para jovem.
No, there were not opportunities here in Sabi. Even if you went to school, you studied, you finished it, you'd like not get a job. So it was really difficult.
Do you remember people coming into Sabi to kind of recruit young men to go into the bush and poach?
Oh, no. No. Ninguém vem aqui dizer, falar disso sobre...
It's not that people coming here to recruit people. It's just someone who is feeling like committing a crime, because it's a crime. Just think of doing it and just suddenly does it.
AJ tells me the syndicates don't necessarily recruit explicitly. They run their businesses by word of mouth. When the first poaching groups were successful, they'd return to the communities with more wealth than most had ever seen. They'd showcase their wins. It was seductive, alluring. He says if you decide to get involved, it's not hard to find someone who can send you. The senders. The middlemen between the top of the syndicates and the men who poach themselves. And these senders are community members, their bosses, uncles, fathers, friends. Do you remember the first time that you heard about it, someone told you, and what did you think?
Ever. Muita coisa, muitas pessoas, né? Posso dizer que muitas pessoas choram por isso, né?
It all just happened, like, all from the sudden. I just saw it happening, and it doesn't really bring happiness to the families. It doesn't bring joy to the family. It just brings sadness. Well, that's what he said. Like, I cannot, like, talk a lot about it.
Like, did you ever get involved in poaching?
You didn't say names, right? I'm a vítima ainda. Sim, já estive envolvido com a caça furtiva.
Não, nunca fui envolvido, nunca participei.
Okay, yeah. Well, he says no, he's never been there, and he just sees things happening, and, well, even, like, the worst is when people die and he hears about it, and I'm damn confused.
Let's pause so I can explain what's going on. Basically, there was a bit of a miscommunication between me, Domingos, and AJ about what he was willing to say on tape. Domingos knows that this friend used to be involved in poaching. In this village, everyone knows who has and who hasn't. We thought since he was going to be anonymous, he was fine with talking about his involvement in poaching. It is in this moment that we realise this isn't the case, and we have to pivot our approach. Domingos tells me that he's happy to talk about poaching, but only in the third person.
Well, maybe we can talk about, like, how do you think poaching has changed Sabi, and especially for young people?
Como você acha que a caça furtiva mudou Sabi, principalmente para os jovens?
Eva, não.
São perguntas diretas,
não é? É, direta mesmo. É o seguinte, mudou um pouco. Posso falar em termos dos transportes, né?
Porque muita gente...
Yes, it does. It brought some big impact in Sabi. Let's see in transportation. For example, we have a lot of cars around because people, when they come from there, they buy cars. It helps people.
And what were downsides for the community?
Há muita desvantagem.
There are a lot of disadvantages. For example, the number of young people in Sabi is reducing a lot because people are getting arrested and killed. I have no other thing to add, but there is a lot of things.
We have to make sure that we don't follow moral panics. Rhinos going extinct, or... There's so many stories and this whole rhino story that you have to actually make sure that you get the right story or understand it's a complex story. There are many stories to it.
Here's Annette Hubschler again. Annette is a sociologist and criminologist at the University of Cape Town.
Quite interestingly, I moved away from criminology and organized crime. So as soon as I started looking into rhino poaching and the rhino horn economy, I actually pulled out my sociologist hat and started trying to understand more about people's backgrounds, how rhino horn actually moved from the source to the market, the history, structural issues. But I very quickly realized actually we need to understand this from the bottom up and don't just come with a lens of organized crime, law enforcement cracking down on people, but actually understanding why is it happening. But we understand very little of the in-between. And organized crime is very easily, well, it's used as a sort of term, okay, there's a very bad entity that is all behind it. But we don't understand that it's often normal people. You know, it's your game farmers that are involved, government officials, policemen and women. You have all sorts of people involved. We needed to understand more about the who, how and what and why. The biggest impact we can make is actually empowering local communities. So, you know, especially as South Africans, we cannot go into China or Vietnam and tell people how to go about, you know, consuming wildlife. It's not our place. I think the biggest change we can do if we do something here, and for me it was just people living close to parks, in parks. Mozambique people are still living in parks. They're sort of on the periphery of society. We're not looking after people, but we expect the same people to look after our rhino or after our wildlife. And until people are actually invested in the good fortunes of rhinos, they're not going to care about rhinos. There's the daily bread and butter, everything that you have to care about. And I think one of the big aha moments was for me when I was sitting with a group of people and they were just saying, we actually don't care about the rhino. We actually think the rhino is much better looked after than us. The rhino has a doctor, it has a helicopter pilot, it has a police officer, it has its own land. We don't have these things. So if the rhino goes extinct tomorrow, maybe we can have those things. And I found also, you know, the rhino was sort of something very distant to a lot of people. Like, oh, the rhino belongs to white people or to rich people. And you don't care about our animals. And a lot of communities living close to major conservation areas farm with cattle or livestock. And there isn't any support for livestock. But local communities are expected to support rhinos or other wildlife. So this massive disconnect.
Most of the people I spoke to who had been involved in poaching told me that the first time they had ever seen a rhino was on a hunt. There was a disconnect between their personal experiences and the issue of rhino extinction. I could see why for them, short-term goals would be more of a priority than the life of an animal that their children might never see, regardless of its endangered status. I asked AJ about how people who decide to poach prepare themselves for a hunt.
Yeah, muitas das vezes é assim mesmo. Quando querem partirem para lá, primeiro vão ao Sangoma.
So, he's saying if people wanted to go there, would first go to the Sangoma, consult the Sangoma, to see how it's going to be. So if they will come back to see how is the path going to happen, you know. And the Sangoma would give some roots to protect them through the way there. So they need the Sangomas.
Sangomas are known in the West as witch doctors. They're highly respected traditional healers who deal in muti and magic. Muti means medicine. And different concoctions are made up, be it animal parts, plant species, or roots. Colonizers brandish the practice of Sangomas as dark dealings, but they are deeply trusted by their community for ritualistic protection and spiritual guidance. Thank you. What you're hearing now is a Sangoma performance. In Changana culture, Sangomas are able to connect to dead ancestors of the land and communicate their voices to the living. They can provide spiritual protection, send warnings, or speak of the future. Visiting a Sangoma is seen to be an essential part of the preparation for a poaching hunt. Because hunters believe if they do not get spiritual protection, they will not know where to find the rhinos, and instead will be captured or killed by the rangers. Poaching is a lucrative source of income for Sangomas, and despite the thousands of poachers who have been caught or killed, even having seen one, there is a strong collective belief in their efficacy. Not all Sangomas will see poachers because the practice of illegal hunting goes against their faith. However, I have heard rumours that some Sangomas double their income by acting as informants for anti-poaching units. Okay, back to AJ.
What is your relationship with or feeling towards the rhinoceros?
A proteção dos rinocerontes, né? Em si, é bem-vindo, porque aquele animal...
He thinks that rhinoceros should be strongly protected from now because his children has to know a rhinocer and his grandchildren has to see a rhinocer as well. So his protection is much important, like now.
I've heard this exact refrain repeated often. That we must save the rhino for future generations, as if it's what people are told to say by anti-poaching campaigns. I can see why AJ would not relate to the sentiment.
For that reason, do you kind of understand the conservationist point of view inside and why they're so strong about protecting the rhino and why they do have guns and stuff?
Concordo, como não concordar? Concordo muito porque
ia ajudar.
So he says he understands, he deeply understands them and he agrees with the militarization of it so that the rhinoceros will be protected. What young people are doing is not really good thing, and the country is losing them all because the country needs them to develop, and they're dying and being arrested. They're involving themselves into the crime and rhino poaching. He thinks, he believes that it's the sender's fault because they're not stopping and they're telling people to go. They're giving much opportunity for young people to go poaching. So,
the senders who are kind of making the money, but they're not actually putting their lives on the line.
Again, the senders are the middlemen between the poachers and the syndicate bosses.
Exatamente isso. Os mandantes aqui estão mais em cima, né?
Yes, they are putting the poacher's life on the line while they earn much money. Well, they just send people without caring if they die or do not die.
So do poachers kind of get involved in the first place because they feel that one day they will, like, work their way up and not have to keep going to the bush but be able to become a sender?
Às vezes outros vão com... Com esse pensativo, né?
So, like, some yes do go thinking that way, but well, it's not always that that happens because the senders don't want you becoming like them. They don't want you becoming as rich as they are.
So I guess I'm just trying to understand genuinely, like, if people know the risks and it's so dangerous and it's affecting the community in bad ways, like, why do people still do it? Why is it still something that people want to sign up for if they're not trying to work their way up?
É mandado hoje, né? Vai, consegue, volta onde ele dá aquele pequeno dinheiro.
It's mainly the poachers themselves that go back to the center, because after they are sent the first time to go there, and then they come, they are given this amount of money, but it's a lot for them, and they start having that life of wealthy. They taste the sweetness of the money, like for the short period of time, and they finish it. They feel like, oh, now I'm broke, and they had to go back to the sender, and they ask, like, I'm broke, boss. Well, and he asks, like, well, what's the idea? What's your plan? And they're like, oh, we can do a game. And then they go back, and it continues happening the same way. It is actually addictive, because if you're used to having like a lot of money as that, then when you're broke, you don't have much more money, you want more, and more and more. So it's addictive.
Do people have an awareness that the rhino is about to become extinct?
As pessoas têm noção de que o rinoceronte está a extinguir-se, está a ser extinto?
Sim, sim. Sabem muito bem.
Yes, yes, they know.
What do the poachers think that they're going to do when it runs out?
Isso é difícil responder, porque mesmo agora está-se a comentar sobre o dinossauro, né?
So he's saying, well, it's just going, the answer is just going to be in history, just like dinosaurs. So they don't really think about it. So, and people will want to know the dinosaur, but they will not know the dinosaur.
É difícil responder. É difícil responder. Porque quando já coisa não existir.
So he said, like, well, it's difficult to answer that question, because, well, they just go there poaching. When it's not their animal, well, it's just dead. It's gone. They don't really care about it.
Is there a link between the historic devaluing of these people's lives and their disregard for the life of a rhino? The way we are socialised from a very young age to conceptualise various things, plants, animals, our relationship to them, and how this becomes a basis for what we are open to doing later in life.
You've taken away land from people. We have a spiritual attachment to our land. It's not about economics. That is where you're from. That's where your ancestors are from.
That's Nwando Achebe talking to Sophie again.
Colonialism has, quote unquote, fallen or crumbled. But the crumbling of colonialism has done nothing to right those wrongs. People are now forced to take on because they have to survive in this world. And so in my mind, forced to do stuff that they mightn't have otherwise done if things were returned to normal, if we were to have rewritten or rewrote some of the abuses, the colonial abuses. Because colonialism really is about coming in and forcefully taking away African land. And you don't give us back our land. And instead, what do? You take a little bitty portion of it. And it's not the most fertile. It is not the best of the land. And you say, okay, you can have this little part of it. But we are keeping the rest of this for us. You leave them no choice. You leave them no choice. If they had other choices, I firmly believe that Africans will not be crossing borders and poaching, knowing full well that the poaching of an animal is the death of that animal. Right? So yes, the righting of that wrong is starting with giving back land, ancestral land, and righting redistribution of wealth, so that it doesn't constantly remain in the hands of elite white Southern Africans, because that's really what has happened.
The
chicken.
Yeah, the chicken. Now it's time for the chicken.
Oh my God.
Yes, so now my mom just is holding and tied the chicken to decapitate it. This is the last minute of its life. It's denying the death and is like fighting with the wings.
So your mom's basically cut its throat and it's still kind of shaking around.
Shaking around, yeah, from all over the place. It doesn't believe it's dead.
It was very quick.
No. And it's still going. Well, they will accept you there. Just go. It's okay.
So now you mean the afterlife will accept you?
Yes, the afterlife will accept it. So now what she wants to do is to take off the... What do you call it?
Feathers?
Yes, the feathers.
So she's pouring boiling water over the...
Its boots are off right now. The shoes are going off.
She's definitely done this before.
Yeah.
Is this a special occasion for your family to be having chicken for dinner?
Yes, of course it is a special occasion. She bought this chicken specially for you because you're visiting and, well, visitors are always welcomed with really good meal, really, you know, fancy meal. And chicken here is a fancy meal just to make sure the visitor feels comfortable and happy and we celebrate the visit. To have visitors is a blessing for this culture, especially. It's a really big blessing. So you have to celebrate the blessings, right? Mm-hmm. So that's how they do. Meat, it's good. So meat is the most fancy way of celebrating. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's why she bought a chicken for you.
The vegetarian.
The vegetarian.
But not tonight.
Yes, not tonight. At least not tonight. I will appreciate it.
I'm obviously a vegetarian, but I also, even when I did eat meat, I was never exposed to the actual killing of the animal that we would eat. It just happened in these places that we didn't see.
I remember studying history that agriculture was one of the oldest practice of human beings. We still depend on agriculture, which means we're still years back, like years behind you. In the Western world. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? We still live in this traditional, and I mean this antiquated way. We just moved from hunting for food at home. Killing animal to eat is like the regular thing you could ever do. It's like normal thing you could ever do. I remember I started even killing goats for a party at home or something. I was only maybe 11 or maybe 10 because I used to help my father since like really, really early age. Every single thing you see there
will get eaten and used.
Yes.
So do you think that that links to why people don't find it too confronting to actually kill a rhino and chop off its horn?
Absolutely. Absolutely linked. Absolutely. Like, that's definitely linked. It's not a big deal, especially because not highly educated or enoughly educated to know the importance of each animal in the environment. Because for us, it's just an animal. The world is too big that... you can never find the end of it. So a lot of animals are out there. There is more.
And maybe because in Western culture, the killing of the animals that we consume is so hidden away, we never have to do it or see it. People are so confronted by the rhino poaching because it's so brutal. The death of a big animal is so confronting because they never have to see dead animals in any aspect of their life.
Well, look, that's really interesting for me to hear. It's really strange to hear that you've never seen an animal being killed. You've never seen an animal being killed, like big animals.
I have seen videos of it. That's why I became a vegetarian, because I started seeing all the videos. But that was mainly in, as we were talking about, like big industry in Australia and America and the UK. And seeing, you know, what your mum is doing right now, I'm actually not feeling confronted at all. She's cutting every single little part of the chicken off, and like every single part will be used. So, I mean, and it's, you don't eat chicken every single meal of your life. It's a special occasion, so you're kind of celebrating the chicken.
Exactly. That's it. Exactly.
Mm.
Later that night, as we sat down to eat, I thought about something Domingo said before I arrived. He told me, "We will treat you as family, as long as you know you are family." I wondered if Domingos would be offered the same in a rural town where I live. Scholar Edward Said wrote, "No one is purely one thing, and labels like Indian or woman or Muslim or American are merely starting points, which if followed into actual experience are quickly left behind. Imperialism consolidated the mixture of cultures and identities on a global scale, but its worst and most paradoxical gift was to allow people to believe that they were only, mainly, exclusively, white or black or Western or Oriental. Yet just as human beings make their own history, they also make their cultures and ethnic identities. No one can deny the influence of long traditions, sustained habitations, national languages, and cultural geographies on identity. But there seems no reason, except fear and prejudice, to keep insisting on their separation and distinctiveness, as if that was all human life was about. Survival, in fact, is about the connections between things. As in Eliot's phrase, reality cannot be deprived of the other echoes that inhabit the garden. It is more rewarding and more difficult to think concretely and sympathetically about others than only about us. But this also means trying not to rule others, trying not to classify them or order them in hierarchies. Above all, not constantly reiterating how our culture or country is superior. The next morning, Domingos tells me he's received a text from a young man we'd met the day prior.
I received a message from the friend that we met yesterday. He's just sent a message in Portuguese. I'll have to translate it directly. I'm sorry. So he's saying, "Good morning, bro. Yesterday, when I called you, I wanted to tell you to be careful, even if you have authorization. Be careful, my bro. People are really worried about us. They know that part is really dangerous. Unfortunately, we have to do the work and we're going there because we have to. This is what we do, right? We will be okay. They will be okay. We have to be okay, right? We have to be okay.
You tell me, Domingos.
Yes, we will be okay."
Poaching has helped this community prosper. In the context of everything we've spoken about this chapter, a tendency to misunderstand, judge, and blame, outsiders sticking their nose into this illegal trade is not something welcomed by all. I have thus far been embraced with open arms, but tone can shift quickly when I begin to ask certain questions. Whilst some hate what poaching has done to their community, others are protective of the businesses they thrive off, and the lives of those threatened by the possibility of getting caught, the lives of those they love.
Invisible Hand was co-created and written by Georgina Savage and Sophie Said in partnership with Case File Presents. It was produced and edited by Georgina Savage. Research and narration written by Sophie Said. Graphic design by Marco Vuleta Djukanov. Original score, sound design, and soundtrack by me, Issa Williams. And to play us out, a collaboration with Kamazu, with a track titled Muntu.
Mina Gawena.